Hello, it is November 17th, 2014. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 454 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. It's the first podcast in a couple of weeks because I am back from vacation. I was in Kauai, Hawaii, you know, the nice island, the one that like that has like, not the one that has the volcanoes, and not the one that's like that has Waikiki, which is basically Tampa, by the way. And we were in Waikiki for one night just to get some sleep before heading to Kauai. And it really is. It's like Tampa. It's like, no offense to Tampa. I mean, I guess Tampa probably wouldn't take offense to that. It would be Waikiki that would take offense to that. But Kauai is a beautiful place. I relaxed for like 4 days, and then I was ready to get back to work. But so I'm back, back in full business. Watched the last game of Todd Gurley's collegiate football career on Saturday here in Athens at Sanford Stadium. We're back to work. It's back to business. College basketball started. Everything is happy. The Arizona Cardinals are 9-1. The world is a beautiful place. So, back to work. I'm very happy to have on today, as today's guest, Kavitha Davidson, or Kavitha A. Davidson. I will ask her whether she prefers to use the A in casual conversation or whether or not that is a byline affectation. But Kavitha Davidson is a sports columnist at Bloomberg View. I'm a big fan of her work. She's on Twitter at Kavitha A. Davidson. She's awesome. She's very smart, and we're very happy to have her on. She, like me, is a generalist, so I like talking to generalists because then you can just like roam. You know, so, like I loved having Matt Norlander on for college basketball. He's a very smart guy, and of course, I could theoretically talk to him about a lot of things. He's a very educated, intelligent man. Except for his love of Dave Matthews for some reason. It's very weird when you find someone you respect professionally and think is incredibly smart and very well learned and knows what they're talking about, and then they like are really into Dave Matthews. It's just kind of a weird thing to discover about somebody. I try to push that out of my mind. And listen, I, you know, really like meatloaf. So I actually like meatloaf. I don't even like the food meatloaf. I actually am just a fan of Marvin Lee a day. So that's probably something that you don't want to know about me. And if you had any respect for me before, it's probably gone now. It's perhaps possible that I've drawn on this intro too long, but you have gotten used to that by now. Here is Kavitha Davidson. All right, first off, Ms. Davidson, thank you for coming on with me. I've been a fan of yours for a while and it is overdue to have you on. You write regularly. How long have you been writing for Bloomberg View?
So I started at Bloomberg View December of last year, and it was really my first kind of major sports gig. So I've been there almost a year now.
So it's funny because, you know, now that I have like one foot in the Bloomberg family, you know, I write my full-time job is Sports on Earth. I love Sports on Earth. Everybody from Sports on Earth is wonderful. Okay, just to make that very clear. But of course, I also write for Bloomberg Politics, which is the new John Heilman, Mark Halperin concoction. It's a funny thing. I'd never actually been to the Bloomberg offices until I was actually in town a few months ago, and I didn't realize it's like Minority Report and it's like floating in the air. Are you in that office every day?
I am in that office almost every day. Sometimes I work off site, but yeah, it's a very cool office. It is a little bit weird. There are fish everywhere and snacks galore. So I guess that that's one thing. I will say that every time I tell people I work in that building, they ask about the circular escalator. That's like the one thing that everyone seems to care about.
The thing that freaked me out when I was there is I went in, and of course, you know, listen, I live in Athens now, but I lived in New York for 14 years. And the one thing that you – New York is a dynamic place with constantly shifting perspectives and everything is different all the time. The one thing you can count on no matter what is the minute you walk into an office building, the person that greets you will be mean and suspicious and or indifferent to you. They are just, like, they don't care about you, that whether you live or die. You're doing nothing but causing them a headache in their day. And I walk into the Bloomberg office and like people come floating to me like, may we get you food? Would you like a beverage? Well, how are you here? Like I could have been the grungiest, most disgusting person, and they welcome me. You walk in as a visitor in that office and they give you beer and they're like, please have a seat in our it's like living in a Delta Sky Club. And
it's true.
Really
there's free soup and there are salads in the summer. It's kind of an odd. Sometimes there are M&Ms. You know, go figure that. Every time I tell people I work at Bloomberg, they ask if there's a limit on how big a soda I can get. And while there is a cup size. You know, I can get as many as I want. So. Yeah.
But I bet you can't get any guns in there, though. That's for sure. That's good. That's good. That's probably a positive thing, actually. So are you enjoying? It's funny, you know. I always enjoy your stuff, but and I love, you know. I used to have this argument years and years ago back during the Deadspin days and shortly after with Dave Zirin, who of course is writes for The Nation and, you know, is very well known in kind of the progressive sports circles. I used to have this argument, you know, I think, you know, I tend to love, one of the things I truly love about sports, you know, I have my own political beliefs, just like every human on the planet does, even if they claim they don't. But, you know, to me, sports is theoretically one of those places where while I know intellectually that politics obviously affects sports, even down to just like everything else in the world, I find it, you know, one of those things that I enjoy, that if I sit next to a guy at a Knicks game who I may disagree with in every single possible thing in the world, but if he or she is a Knicks fan, we're best friends. And that's one of the things I love about sports. So I always have this argument with Zirin about, it wasn't so much the argument, but like how much you can keep. I like to live in like the bubble where politics, you know, I try not to think about it when I'm watching sports, even though intellectually I know it's a part of it. He's kind of come around. I've kind of come around to his mindset a little bit, but I'm curious. You know, you've come from a little bit of a politics background. When you write about, you know, I think the world of progressivism in sports, it's changed sports, I think, a lot in the last few years. I think for the better, but I think for some people that try to keep that thing, they would argue that it's harder to keep them separate. I'm curious, what's your perspective when you come in to write a piece? Do you come from a politics perspective or sports perspective? Can you separate the two or not?
You know, I think that as far as my writing is concerned, I definitely come to it with a politics perspective, just because, you know, that's what I'm trying to bring to the space. Sports writing is so crowded, and we have so many great beat reporters and so many great people who do just, you know, straight on the field analysis, that I think that that's a space that I can't really contribute to as much as other people who are there. When you're talking about whether you can separate your politics from your sports affiliation, absolutely, that's definitely possible. Is it realistic to do so all the time? I don't think that that's necessarily true. And I think when you talk about, you know, the changes that progressivism have brought to sports media and sports fandom in the last couple of years, I think that they've overall been positive. You know, you like to think that, you know, I get comments from readers all the time who say, you know, kind of stick to sports a little bit.
Of course.
Which, frankly, I think is a criticism that women get more than men do in this space, mm-hmm. but that's an issue in itself. You know, I think that at the end of the day, all of us are sports fans, not because of our political affiliations, right? I mean, you know, you talk about, you sit at a Knicks game next to a fan, no matter who they are, where they're from, and you have this one common thing, and it's the team that you root for, and that's what really first drew me in when I went to my first Yankee game when I was 6 years old, and you know, that really is the reason I'm a sports fan. But I think if you grow older, you start to see things in a more critical lens. And I suppose that, you know, while sports is supposed to be an escape and it absolutely serves that purpose, the ability to not look at sports in a political lens is kind of a privilege. And it's not a privilege that some of us are afforded. You know, I can't watch an NFL game and see the way that female sideline reporters are treated sometimes and not think of, you know, how that applies to me, how that applies to broader implications of women in media and women in male-dominated industries in general. And I think that, you know, especially growing up, no matter where you grew up, you know, I grew up in New York City, so, you know, a relatively progressive place. But when you grow up as a sports fan, going to certain schools or in certain intellectual spaces, there's this kind of artificial divide between jock culture and intellectual culture. And I think what progressive sports writing and progressive sports fans have started to do is bridge that divide and say that, you know, sports doesn't have to be primarily conservative, realm. And at the same time, you know, there isn't anything anti-intellectual about being a sports fan. And there are certain things that we can bring to sports fandom and sports writing that might be politically informed. You know, I do understand that there is a fatigue about, you know, everything that we read about and everything that we write about, everything that we cover has a certain right versus left connotation. But, you know, that's kind of just the nature of the internet nowadays. Mm-hmm. It's the nature of every kind of interaction and every kind of industry far beyond sports. So, you know, I think that overall the politicization of sports, if we want to put it that way, is actually a really positive thing.
Yeah, and probably inevitable. You know, it's all that old kind of idea that, There's this old joke about baby boomer sports writers that, everyone wants baseball to be exactly like all baby boomer sports writers. They all want baseball to be exactly the way it was when they were like 12. And which of course, by the way, it was full of corruption and full of cheaters and full of everything like it is now. It's just you didn't know that because you were 12. And so, and I think you're right. I think it's an interesting way to kind of add in privilege to that idea too, because you're right. Like I can like I my life. I'm obviously like I'm a grown person. I have children. I have a job. Like, but generally speaking, my life is not dramatically different than the way it was when I was 12. I could still be like, oh yes, this is I love the Cardinals or the I didn't like the Knicks when I was 12, but I love the Cardinals or the Illini as now as much as I did when I was 12. And hey, goody for me, because I can like live in that little pretend universe. I think you're right, but I'm curious though when it comes to like let's say. Someone that grew up a fan of the Washington football team. I think they're the one we always fall on this. And I have to say, I'm actually glad that I'm not a fan. I didn't grow up a fan of the Washington football team because I feel like it would just be a hard to listen. The Arizona Cardinals have all sorts of corruption on their team and all sorts of junk, just like every other team in the NFL. But for some reason, I feel like it would be actively difficult for me as a functioning member of society and a someone I think means well. I would have such a hard time separating that I feel like it would take a lot of the fun out of it for me. Is there a route to that? Is there a route to love the Washington football team and hate everything else about them?
Well, absolutely, and I don't think that I think that most rational Washington football team fans that you meet maybe perhaps in our more progressive social circles, have found a really good way around that. They try to avoid using the name, they try to avoid wearing the logo, but that doesn't take away from their pride in their team. I guess after today's game, maybe not so much. But at the same time, who in sports doesn't have an owner or a part of their team
Right.
that hasn't at some point been abhorrent? I love George Steinbrenner, but he was a terrible human being. Like, it doesn't make me less of a Yankee fan. I can be critical of my team. I can be critical of my owner. And, this comes up in college sports as well. I can be critical of my institution. The same way that we say being a really, involved and good and participatory American involves having doubt in our own political system and criticizing the things that we see wrong and looking for reform. I think that it's actually, a prime form of fandom to be able to maintain your team affiliations and still try to seek to make better what needs to be changed. So, I don't think that being, I do think that it is, it would be a little bit difficult to be a fan of the Washington football team nowadays, but I don't think that it's nearly impossible. And I think that you can also, all areas of sports need to be looked at with some certain level of cynicism. I think that that's something that you and Deadspin have done very well in this space. So, I think that that's just kind of how you have to go about it with all of your sports teams and kind of with most things in life nowadays, unfortunately.
But see, and that's the thing. It's hard because really deep down, like we're all applying rationalism when we're talking about the Washington football team or we're talking about Jerry Jones or we're talking about Ray Rice or we're talking about like, rational, we're using rational thought. The way that I think that you write about sports and the way I try to write about sports and I think the best sports writers write about sports and the best sports TV people for that they talk, you know what I mean? They try to do it rationally. They try to do it logically, and they try to use reason and facts and discussions, which is great and is what we all should be doing. But then you take a step back and you realize there's absolutely nothing rational about being a sports fan in the first place. And at the end of the day, I always fall back on that like inevitably the leap that we had to make to for the, it, like, it obviously make the St. Louis Cardinals do not care about me. They are a big million-dollar corporation that is there to make money off me. They sell themselves as a family because that's something that's what they sell. Like that, no, these are all big corporations that are making white men very, very wealthy. And they, if I went away in a second, they would not even remember I was ever there in the first place. It doesn't make any sense to care about sports. It just doesn't. Like rationally speaking, individualistic speaking, it doesn't make any sense. But we do it, and it's inherently irrational. So what I have a hard time with sometimes is making that leap. Inevitably, I hit a point where I'm like, you know what? I really am outraged by this, and I'm really frustrated by this, and I do not like that this exists in sports. But I still like sports, and so I have to like I find myself having almost to check it at the door a little bit. We saw this a lot with the NFL. Like, it's for 5 weeks, everyone was like, the NFL's in so much trouble. They're so screwed. And then they played a bunch of games and everyone just kind of moved on. And so that's what I mean is, like, on a certain level, I like that there is this more thought about sports. I like that we're holding things up to closer scrutiny. I still feel like as long as the bad guys have sports on their side, I always think they're still going to win.
Right. Well, I think that you actually wrote about this very eloquently when you addressed, you know, should you feel guilty about watching football during the whole Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson thing? And you kind of said, you know, as you stated now, sports fandom in itself is not a particularly rational thing. What it is an outlet for, you know, our more basal instincts towards kind of, you know, war and rooting against a common enemy and having, you know, these kind of collective feelings that aren't rational but are certainly in heightened emotions. And at the end of the day, it's a really, it's a non-consequential way to go about that, right? You know, whether, you know, the New York Giants win the Super Bowl or the Philadelphia Eagles win the Super Bowl, you know, I might get into a fight with an Eagles fan about that, but, you know, that doesn't actually have any real world consequence. So you're right in that sense, that the base of the very, you know, inherent base of being a sports fan isn't particularly rational. I think being able to separate those things that don't actually have any real world consequence with the kind of things that do, and they don't always have to be talked about, you know, in black and white or left and right or very, you know, polarizing ways, but, you know, there are certain you know, ways to kind of examine how sports has been a mirror for our society, and it's always been a mirror for our society. You know, if you go back 100, 150 years, the birth of sports in America has kind of mirrored the way that our economy has changed and our racial dynamics have changed, our immigration policy have changed and things like that. You know, to ignore that, that those implications aren't there, kind of ignores how sports is actually more meaningful than I think sometimes we give it credit for. Yes, it's a form of entertainment, but, you know, sometimes it's the way for an entire, you know, population of people to kind of seek refuge in the United States and to get citizenship. And sometimes it's a way for, you know, immigrant groups to assimilate into the broader society. And sometimes it's a way for poor people to get college scholarships, as sad as that is. So, you know, at the end of the day, if we can separate the things that we're fighting about in that way from the non-consequential to the things that actually have real-world implications, I think that we'll have a smarter discourse. But, of course, you know, right now we're at a time when we're just kind of yelling at each other about everything, whether it matters or not, and that includes sports.
Yeah, and I want to actually talk specifically to your experience here because, yeah, you know, because you come from a politics background, I'm always kind of fascinated with this. Obviously, with my work for Bloomberg Politics, I have a deep fascination for the world of politics. And I'm curious, who yells at you more and or louder, sports fans or political people?
So, mostly it's sports fans. You know, being a woman who writes about sports, I'm constantly going to be yelled at when I write something critical about someone's team and they don't like that. You know, during the height of the Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson controversies, which are obviously still going on now, I was receiving a lot of criticism from, I won't say domestic violence apologists, but maybe people right. who didn't really understand right. the intricacies of it. And, you
that
know,
was
I
nice
recall
of you,
them,
that was nice of you not to say domestic violence apologists, but domestic violence apologists.
Well, I think that there's a difference between, you know, some of them were definitely apologists, but
right.
a lot of them just frankly don't understand how the dynamics of domestic violence work or how victimization works. So, you know, we have a lot of people who are asking, for example, why did Janae Rice go back to Ray Rice and marry her? And that caused me to write a column that this was the wrong question that we were asking, but also kind of try to explain to a broader sports audience how, you know, the victim complex actually works psychologically. And then you have a lot of people, again, yelling at you to stick to sports and to stop covering this. And, you know, you're just, you know, kind of staying on this angle because it's headline worthy and things like that. Ironically, the most hate mail, I shall say, that I get is when I write about either the Washington football team or Penn State football. Which I guess shouldn't be too much of a surprise because we know how fervent those fans are. But I think that people, you know, I think that it speaks to a very common thing that people take their team allegiances as a marker of their own identity. And that can happen for better or for worse. So when you hear any kind of controversy and criticism, especially coming from the outside, you take that as a criticism of yourself and of things that you tend to believe. But again, like I said before, I think the ability to criticize these institutions, especially from a fan perspective, is one of the rights and the privileges of being a sports fan.
Have you read anything about Florida State yet? That tends to be the one that gets that I get the anytime I touch Winston, man, like those guys go crazy.
So my first column for Bloomberg was actually about Jameis Winston.
Yeah, yeah.
I have written a couple of times about him, just his kind of immature behavior and whether or not he's equipped for a locker room culture when he's already kind of been enabled by the college football culture that has allowed him to sustain his behavior. College football is really interesting. Coming from New York City, you don't really get that kind of a background as far as like fandom, but then when you start writing about college football, you have all of these people who have been passed down for generations, their allegiances, and they really take it to heart. So yeah, definitely Jameis Winston is a touchy territory whenever I go there.
Yeah, college football is crazy. I mean, obviously, I lived in New York for 14 years and then came to one of the biggest college football towns in America.
Right.
And it's funny too, because I tell people, one of the things I love about living here is nobody really cares what you do for a living. Like they just don't care. So like, you're like a sport. Like if I tell someone I write about sports, they just want to know if I've interviewed, Steve Spurrier, and otherwise they don't care.
Right.
but it's always funny because and I wonder if part of this is too, because for years and years and years and years and years, college football, it's always been big, but it's also, it's very tribal. It's very local. Georgia football is obviously a big thing, is a big thing, a major college football institution. But here it really, this is a small college town. These are small college towns that they are the Yankees times 50. Here and in these places. And so people will ask me, so the sports writer, and I'm like, yes, so what do you think of the fourth string strong safety for Georgia? And I'm like, no, I write about lots of things. And they're like, there are other things? So I find that as these things go more and more national, I wonder, now I think a part of this is a byproduct too of sports becoming much more powerful because of television. And therefore, mm-hmm. there's more money and there's more exposure. And frankly, there's just more people talking about this shit than there used to be. And I wonder, I have a hard time with it sometimes. I feel like you're better at this. I feel like you're very good at being confrontational without being confrontational. Like you're able to,
well,
of course, in all seriousness, even with the way that you answered the question before, when I was like, oh, you're not, I know you're being nice and not calling the domestic violence apologist. And even then you tried to find a uniting thing about that and not, you're not just, you're not trolling people, to use the parlance of the day. And I appreciate that. But, and I feel the same way, but it's hard for me. And this is, frankly, it's something I've struggled as the years go along, and frankly, as I've gotten older, is I still want sports at my core to be uniting. I want it at my core. It is, to me, the thing that I love most about sports is I want it to be, obviously, there's going to be a divide between Cardinals fans and Cubs fans. There's going to be a divide between people on all different sides. But I inherently, the thing that I love about sports is it is one of the few things left that can both unite and also is at its core very simple. If my team wins, I'm happy. If my team loses, I'm sad. And I find the way that discourse is now that more and more difficult to do, which is why I keep asking you about politics, which is inherently, by very definition, adversarial. Do you think that there is a uniting thing in sports, or is it the same as politics? Do you see where I'm going? What I'm banging my head against here?
I do, absolutely. I think part of what you're describing is, the the tribalization, I suppose, of sports, and that's kind of been enabled by, you know, fan sites that are geared towards specific teams that never used to get national coverage. So now you have an SB Nation site for every team that exists, right. And now you have an outlet for these, you know, somewhat marginalized fan bases to go to. What that does do is that it kind of creates the illusion, I suppose, that there is more division than there ever was. But you know, the fact of the matter is, I think that there was always this kind of level of division. It just wasn't. It didn't have a platform to shine, and there wasn't Twitter that we could actually amplify this through. I think when it comes down to it, when it really matters, we do see that sports still unite us. I think the number one example that we tend to point to, and you know, this was 13 years ago now, but during 9/11, you had Red Sox fans and Yankee fans holding hands. During the Boston Marathon bombing last year, you had the same thing happening. You have really powerful, you know, at some point people are actually able to put aside these things that don't actually matter in the grand scheme of things when something that really does matter confronts them with it. So, you know, I think that, and you see this with owners who get sick, and you see this kind of everywhere that when something like this happens, you do see this like uniting force that sports is capable of engendering. The problem is that it just doesn't seem like that happens so often because we have, you know, different outlets and different voices. I don't think that celebrating that diversity is necessarily a bad thing, and I don't think that necessarily divides us further. I think it's just a little bit more honest about the differences that we have. And frankly, as you know, as the demographics of our country change, sorry to bring this back to politics.
No.
You know, as the demographics of our country change and as they start to shift towards a more, you know, kind of diverse populace, it's we need to figure out a way to engage our you know, different sports affiliations or different socioeconomic affiliations and try to, you know, figure out the common ground there. And I think it's just kind of indicative of where the broader society is going that we have what is perceived to be these broader divisions.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. This is the first time you and I have actually, like, you know, we've interacted online before, but like most people, we've interacted online before and feel as if we have some actual understanding of each other without ever actually spoken before. But I'd like to say, you're making me feel so much better about this. I may have to call you like a lot, like every time and particularly coming from someone who, frankly, as you say, working as a woman in this business, I wrote about this with when the Michelle Beadle thing happened, about trying to step back and realize that, like, no matter what, like, there's literally nothing you can say that's not going to get you yelled at for being a woman in sports. Like, there's nothing.
Well, that's
right?
Definitely true. That's definitely true. They're always, you know, really fantastic pieces about harassment that women in the media have to face, and women in sports media are definitely among them. I think what you're seeing with Gamergate is basically, if you're a woman in any kind of male-dominated industry, it's just a little bit harder. So that's definitely true. But I will say that for every nasty tweet I get a really lovely email from a reader, male or female, who thanks me for something that I've written, for bringing a new perspective, for representing a perspective that isn't represented before. And I think that goes to, you know, I guess the expansion of our media and definitely our sports media as well, is that before, you know, we didn't have so many intellectual voices that could actually, you know, bring light to broader issues within the world of sports. So that was kind of left to non-sports writers to do. And now what we have is we have people who, you know, from Dave Zirin to, you know, you, to, you know, like across the spectrum, who can actually write very intelligently about some of these issues, but also have a sports knowledge. So it doesn't seem like you're just, like, you know, you're just being kind of yelled at by a political writer or by someone from, like, a non-sports publication. And I think that that's really important, that we now have people who can do both. And obviously, you know, as we get more women in sports media, that'll broaden the perspectives even more. But the barriers are obviously still there, and it's still really difficult to talk about certain things. But I think that people are becoming more receptive to it, and frankly, you know, people will always be mad when their views are challenged. But so, you know, once in a while, for every five people that get mad at you for writing about something that kind of rubs them the wrong way, the one guy who writes you and says, "Thank you for changing my perspective on this," or "Thank you for putting this in a way that I'd never read or heard it be put before," that makes it all worth it. And that's really, you know, that's really the purpose, I think, of some of what we do.
Yeah, it's the old thing they always said about TV stations: the idea that before email and Twitter, the idea that for every one positive letter was worth like 500 negative ones, because people just get angry. Like people don't usually. It's the same thing as the media itself. Like people don't do media updates and say everything is cool. Here's a really nice thing that happened. Here's someone doing good. Like it's the way it works. Yeah, you know, we point out negative things, and you're right. And that's why I'm saying this is why I'm gonna have to call you a lot, because you still have this, either that or you just got this great attitude while dealing with the stuff that you must have to deal with on a regular basis. How long? I want to. We had all these topics that we were going to talk about. I just kind of knew we'd get going off on other stuff because I had so many things I wanted to talk to you about. One thing I want to talk briefly, I saw you on the TV on the after a column you wrote about sports gambling. And this is the big thing now with Adam Silver and his op-ed. Basically, they're pushing sports gambling in a lot of ways. And you know, I famously, like, the origin story of Deadspin is that I didn't want to do the gambling blog. Gawker had a contract from Bodog, which is an old gambling site, I think it's gone now, for 6 months of a gambling site. And they'd seen my work on the Black Table and said, "Hey, do you want to do a gambling site?" And I said, "Actually, I think gambling is really wrong for sports and terrible for it. And I would be, so that would make me a horrible person to run for your gambling site. But you guys should do a sports site." And I pitched it all up and then became Deadspin. And now people actually read it, as opposed to back when I did it. And anyway, so the point is that, like, I have an inherent, like, for me, and this probably goes back to my imaginary world where sports could be somehow pure or something, but could be somehow outside of the ugliness of the real world. But, like, to me, you know, I'm one of those guys that think Pete Rose shouldn't be near the Hall of Fame. He hurt the game. Gambling to me is the, you know, baseball, sports can survive a lot of things, and I'm not sure they can survive gambling. And you wrote a very smart piece, I thought, and talked about it on the TV on MSNBC about this, about how this is kind of the way things are going, and the more out in the open it is, the more ultimately long term it's good for good sports. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I think that I see where you're coming from, you know, the criticism against gambling. And I think in a vacuum, I would tend to agree with you. I don't really personally understand the appeal for betting on sports. It's not something that I would be interested in. That said, it's clearly something that a lot of people are interested in. And you know, I don't see realistically how we can continue along with this $400 billion black market, or whatever the actual number is. That's the number that Adam Silver cited in his op-ed. You know, I think that the same thing with marijuana legalization, the same thing with alcohol, and, you know, the arguments for legalizing prostitution, for example, or that, you know, these are all vices that I suppose we can have some kind of moral judgment on. As a society, I think that our behavior has at least shown that we condone these particular vices, and it's better to kind of move all of these activities above ground. It's better to tax and regulate. It's better to have you know, safeguards in place instead of just kind of pretending like it doesn't happen, which I don't think really serves anybody broadly. I will say that you know, while the tax revenue that could be garnered from taxing legal sports betting would definitely help the states, I think that it might also be used in order to, you know, kind of sidestep other actually impactful economic initiatives that states could be doing. And I think that that's something that we need to guard against. I think New Jersey is actually a really good example of that. But at the same time, you know, pretending like this isn't something that's happening as rampantly as it is isn't really doing us any good. You know, on a broad level, you know, I think that Keith Olbermann actually made a really good point where he said on Friday that if we're going to go down this path, and it looks like we are, If we're going to legalize sports betting, then it's up to the sports leagues to get involved in, combating the 1-2% of compulsory gamblers who actually have a psychological addiction and try and get out in front of this, because this will cause a few problems. But I don't think that there are problems that aren't happening right now already. I think that this is an opportunity to actually, try to put some oversight over something that's kind of existed under a black cloud for a really long time at this point.
Yeah, you're the 1-2 punch of you and Chuck Klosterman's ethicist piece in the New York Times Magazine this weekend, mm-hmm. which was actually about, I don't know if you saw it. I'm a longtime aficionado of the ethicist column. I love the ethicist column, and like for Randy Cohen and back before that. And I think Klosterman is actually right. The best ethicist they have. And he brought up an excellent point about this, which is the idea, because my fear about sports gambling, it's going to make someone throw a game. Like that's my, like to me, that's the one thing I cannot abide. I can abide tanking. I love tanking. Tanking is great, but I can't really abide, someone throwing a game on purpose. And he brought up the point that like the problem is if this is above board and this is all legal, the thing that we worry about is someone is a player gambling on games and then getting in so much debt through illicit, through illegal betting, that they have to do something or they'll be in danger. Whereas in an actual world where it is legislated and people are like watching it, I feel like that's less likely it's going to happen. So your piece in that have convinced me. Unfortunately, I'm now helplessly addicted to gambling. So thanks, guys.
Well, you're welcome. I will say that as far as, the corruption into the game, I think that's a real consideration, but I don't think that that's a real consideration when it comes to the players. For the most part, if we look at just where player salaries are now versus, back when Pete Rose happened and going all the way back to the Black Sox scandal, it's just gotten to the point where it's more risky for a player to, kind of sacrifice his potential payday or his payout, especially in Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association, for whatever the quick payout would be from throwing a game or from gambling on games. I think that what we can be concerned about is absolutely something that we would need to address once if sports betting becomes legal is officials and basically anyone else on the sidelines who have interest in the game that might not make the millions that we talk about with players. But that's also something that we've already had to address with the NBA, especially, right? We had a whole refereeing scandal without, the 50 states legalizing gambling. And I think that what it really comes down to is that if somebody wants to bet on a game, they're going to find a way to do it. Four states already have it legal. And at the end of the day, is it really that much of a deterrent that it's that you kind of have to go through Vegas or through some of these like back channels in order to make that happen? If you're the kind of person who is, if you're a referee or something and you're traveling around a lot and you have, access to, staff and things like that, then it's probably not that difficult for you to go to Vegas and place a bet. It's definitely illegal and it's definitely against the NBA bylaws. And that's something that we will have to address, if and when legal gambling expands. But I don't think that we have so much to worry about when it comes to players. And frankly, if we do have a player who's in so much debt that he needs to resort to gambling or that he resorts to gambling as a crutch in itself, then that's a behavioral issue that we should be addressing separately.
Yeah, I know. You're right. I always think of something Roger Ebert said about Stanley Kaufman. He was his favorite film critic, and he's like, "Listen, I'm a film critic, and I have my own views, and this is how I make my living." And because they asked him what other critics he likes, and he said, "Well, the only problem I kind of hate Stanley Kaufman because every time I disagree with I see something and I write my review, and then I read Stanley Kaufman, and when he disagrees with me, I start to question myself." There are a few people like that. Dave's like that. Craig's is like that. And there's a few people out there. You are one of those people. So please.
Oh, well, thank you.
But you're making me, like, all it does is just remind me of my inferiority as a thinker. So thank you very much. So anyway, thank you for your time. Now, is there a specific page? Because, one of the things that I have, Bloomberg Politics got this fancy new design. and it's really pretty and it looks nice, but there's no actual single landing page that I can send people to. I actually had to put up a page on my Tumblr site to just say, here's all the Bloomberg stuff, because there's no like actual Will Leach or Dave Weigel or so on writing page there. Is there a place where people can, without question, just bookmark, if that tells you how old, and like bookmark that, people still do that, right? Is there a place where, without question, people can read your stuff that's the easiest way to do it?
Well, I would definitely recommend following me on Twitter at Kavitha Davidson. The Bloomberg View homepage is bloombergview.com. And if you see any one of my articles, you can click my name and it'll bring you to my contributor page. I won't give you the whole long URL for that, but there is my particular contributor page on there with a silly little photo of me and an RSS feed button as well, where you can follow my writing.
Oh, yeah. There's RSS. Okay, I didn't know there was RSS. All right, then never mind. RSS is the easiest way to do it because RSS... again, I'm old. I still use RSS. I love annoying people with like, hey, when people launch a site, does your site have RSS? No, it's not 2005. So no, it doesn't have RSS. So I'm very glad to have that. Well, thank you very much, Kavitha, for coming on. And thank you for kicking ass. And now you're going to hang around for trivia. We're going to do trivia. They'll run a couple of days. And I know you're nervous about it. Everyone is always nervous about it. So don't be. Don't be nervous.
Okay.
The problem, if someone does well or someone does poor, if someone does well, it's because they're really smart. And if they do poorly, it's because I wrote the questions poorly. So remember that.
Okay.
No matter what. But mostly.
All right. Well, you know, if I've made you question your ability as a thinker, then you will have made me question my ability as a sports fan. So I guess we can call it even.
It'll be fine. All right. Thank you, Kavitha. I'm honored to have you on, and I'd love to have you on again sometime.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Will.
Okay, thank you to Kavitha A. Davidson. Oh, I forgot to ask you. Do you have you always used the A? When I was in college, I always wanted to go like by W. F. Leach the Third because I was in college. But I kind of like my name as a byline because it's two. It's not like, you know, it's two words, one syllable each, so it's easy to remember. But right. It's not like Ed. Ed Bo or something. That's not like two little words. Does anyone? I always like one of the things. I it's funny. Like I will always, if I ran into Samuel Jackson, I would say hello, Samuel L. Jackson, because like that's how I know them. And he would be like, please, it's Sam. Stop it, you weirdo. It's like a sign that I don't know them. Are you differentiating yourself from another Kavitha Davidson? Do you like the AI? I always wonder about this because I get obsessed with bylines and forget that there are actual people that are called other things in the real world.
Well, so I'm not actually separating myself from another Kavitha Davidson. I think if you search Kavitha Davidson, I will be your top Google hit, and then there will be a doctor somewhere that will probably be your next one. No, you know, the A in my middle name doesn't need to be pronounced when you're referring to me. I'm not Samuel L. Jackson. But my middle name is Angela, and it stands for my aunt who has passed away, but that my father named after me. So I thought it was just a nice tribute to her to have it be in my byline.
That's a wonderful reason. I was a question. I love it. Like I've always wished that, because I feel like you have the kind of gravitas as a writer to pull it off, and I can't.
Oh, thank
you. I could not be like, hey, here's some armpit jokes about St. Louis Cardinals love by William F. Leach. Like I just don't think I couldn't pull it off, but you actually can pull it off because you know what you do. So anyway, thank you for that. Thanks to Kavitha Davidson. You can follow her on Twitter at Kavitha A. Davidson, KavithaDavidson. This has been the Will Leach Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We'll be back in two days, with Kavitha's trivia that we're going to do right now, but you won't hear it for two more days. So you can let us, we'll see how it works. All right. Have a great day. We'll talk to you and Kavitha and everyone else later.